From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to this additional episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Barbarossa. 80 years ago, in June 1941, Nazi Germany invaded the Soviet Union in what Hitler hoped would be a lightning campaign to destroy Bolshevism and provide living space for his empire in the East. The result was 4 years of brutal conflict, which shaped the world we live in today. What did the codebreakers at Bletchley Park know about the German plans of attack? Was Stalin warned? And how did the war in the East play out at BP? In this It Happened Here episode, we are, as usual, joined by our research historian, Dr. David Kenyon, to tell us more about the signals intelligence picture on the Eastern Front. Special thanks go to Dr. Ben Thompson for voicing our archival documents.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
Our last podcast episode, Valgelb, related to the events of 1940 because it was held over from last year's schedule. Obviously, the pandemic interrupted our programming, but we are back now, and we're back to our anniversaries. This episode is 80 years from the start of Operation Barbarossa. David, can you give us some background? What was Operation Barbarossa?
Operation Barbarossa is the code name the Germans give to the first part of the war against the Soviet Union in the Second World War. And their invasion of the Soviet Union began 80 years ago on the 22nd of June, 1941. Barbarossa is remembered as one of the largest military operations that's ever taken place. There were something like 3.8 million German military personnel involved. And they literally attacked the whole frontage of the Soviet Union. So there's troops more or less from the Black Sea all the way up to the Arctic. So it's an enormous undertaking. But in common with the German operations against France and against Norway previously in 1940, it was intended to be a short-term thing. It was intended to be another blitzkrieg, another lightning operation that, although it used enormous resources, would succeed very, very quickly. The original plan was to win the war in 4 or 5 months and to, you know, it'll be over by Christmas kind of thing.
Feels like there's a but coming here.
There is a but coming here. It doesn't work. The Nazis had underestimated the resilience of the Soviet Union, but their plan kind of does work because what they were able to do is encircle huge numbers of Soviet troops in the opening weeks of the operation, and they captured literally millions of prisoners. And that would have knocked any normal country out of the war. But actually, the Soviets were able to pull back and regroup and find even more troops. And by the time they tied the Germans down until winter came, then Germany is basically lost by that point. They don't realize it. But what the outcome is that they fight on and it becomes an enormous and brutal struggle that lasts for 4 years until 1945. We in the West tend to focus on the British story of the Second World War. So we remember D-Day, we remember El Alamein in North Africa, things like that. But actually, if you look at the sheer numbers, the Second World War is won and lost in the East, on the Eastern Front. That's where the majority of the soldiers are. That's where the majority of the fighting happens. And sadly, that's where the majority of the dying happens. I mean, the figures for both military and civilian casualties on the Eastern Front run to something like 26 million people. So it's an extraordinary event.
Those are staggering numbers. And you say that's directly related to the events that we'll be talking about today?
The following on from those events, so we're going to concentrate on the opening stages of the battle, but we will talk a little bit about the later campaign. And that's something like 8 million Soviet armed forces, but also a huge civilian loss. And in many ways, the Russia that the West is confronted with today, in order to understand how their mind works, you have to understand just how important this operation, the Great Patriotic War, as the Russians call it, how important those events are to their whole history and culture. And it was such a profound event for them. I mean, I don't know if you've experienced this with your contacts with Russians.
I have visited Russia on a number of occasions, and it's true, the Great Patriotic War, it's huge, it's a significant...
And the memorials are equally huge, aren't
absolutely.
They?
Absolutely, and the days, the events associated with it in order to remember it. Yeah, absolutely. A huge part of the culture.
But that was not the Germans' plan at the beginning. They were hoping that it would all be over very, very quickly and that Stalin would roll over and give them what they wanted, essentially.
Which leads me to thinking, weren't Germany and Russia quite friendly? Weren't relations between them relatively good at this point in 1940?
Yes, they were. We will come to how Britain and Bletchley Park fit into this story shortly. But what we have to remember is after the 22nd of June 1941, the Soviets suddenly become allies of Britain and then subsequently the United States. But up until the invasion, they are, if not the enemy, then certainly friends with the enemy. You go right back to the 20s and 30s, when the Treaty of Versailles was signed at the end of the First World War, it put massive restrictions on what the Germans could do with their armed forces. They weren't allowed to have an air force at all, really. They were restricted on tanks and restricted on numbers of men and everything else. So what they did was they did a deal with the Bolsheviks where they would do technical development and training and all sorts of other activities in the Soviet Union where they could hide them from Western eyes. And they traded technology with the Russians in that way. That carries on. By the time you get to Hitler's rise to power, he is less keen on the military collaboration and that more or less stops. But Germany is still reliant on raw materials from the East and the Russians are still keen to gain manufactured products from Germany. So a trade relationship carries on. And when you get to 1939, you have the famous Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, as it was called. Molotov is the Russian foreign secretary and Ribbentrop is the German foreign secretary.
Right.
They sign a non-aggression pact. This is a deal not to fight each other, basically. What the rest of the world doesn't see is there are secret protocols in that pact which carve up Poland. And we all remember 1st of September 1939, German tanks roll into Poland. Actually, they only conquer half of Poland because the other half is conquered by the Soviet Union under a deal that they've cut with the Nazis. So the two sides have been collaborating on the partition of Poland and on trade, and they continue to do so. They sign another trade agreement in February 1940. So they are still apparently friendly.
Apparently.
To external eyes, and their PR is that they are friendly to each other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we all know that Stalin wasn't actually very friendly to anybody at the end of the day. But also, you have to remember Hitler has a deep-seated ideological hatred of Bolshevism and communism and of the Slavs, the Eastern populations. If you go back to Mein Kampf in 1926, he writes a whole chapter about how he wants to get rid of these people and take over their resources and their land and everything else. So his friendship and collaboration with the Soviet Union is always going to be temporary. There's always going to be a point where, you know, on his to-do list is conquer Russia, tick. You know, it's down there as part of his long-term plan. So it's not if, it's when he turns on Russia is the point. One of the ironies of the trade relationship is that Germany relies on raw materials from the Soviet Union to fight the war that's already fighting. Things like oil and petroleum, grain from Ukraine, rubber, other minerals like manganese are all being sent from Russia under the existing trade deals. And although Hitler's long-term plan is to grab those resources for Germany indefinitely, the first thing that happens when he invades Russia is, of course, all those resources are cut off from him. So in the short term, he's cut off his own nose to spite his face, really. He's put Germany in a worse position than if they hadn't attacked them. But obviously his plan was that he would push Stalin right back to the Urals and all of this stuff in the Western Soviet Union would be his to play with.
This is London. Soon it will be spring in England. Already there are flowers in the parks, although the parks aren't quite as well kept as they were at this time last year. The winter that is ending has been hard. But Londoners have many reasons for satisfaction. There have been no serious epidemics. The casualties from air bombardment have been less than expected. And London meets this spring with as much courage, though less complacency, than at this time last year. The other day, watching a farmer trying to fill in a 20-foot deep bomb crater in the middle of his field, I wondered what would happen before he harvested the next crop from that bomb-torn soil. I suppose that many more bombs will fall. There will be much talk about equality of sacrifice, which doesn't exist. Many proud ships will certainly perish in the Western approaches. There will be further restrictions on clothes and food. Probably a few profiteers will make their profits. No one knows whether invasion will come, but there are those who fear it will not.
Tell us then, when did the German planning for Operation Barbarossa begin?
It's been in Hitler's mind, as we say, for a decade, but his original plan was France, then the UK, then once the UK had been dealt with, then Russia. But in the summer of 1940, the plans for Operation Sea Lion, Seelöwe, which was the plan to conquer Britain, are starting to break down. It's becoming apparent that Britain isn't going to be invaded anytime soon, really. So as early as July 1940, we think of, you know, the Battle of Britain in September hasn't really happened at that point, but that he's already getting nervous about his timetable, and he starts to think about a plan in the Soviet Union. In July, Hitler turns to his planners, and they come up with a thing called Operation Otto, which is the sort of first phase ideas-level planning for an invasion of the Soviet Union to happen the following year in probably May.
So July is only 5 months after this trade agreement where they're exchanging resources in February 1940 that you've been telling us about. That seems like a very fast change of mind, or moving quite quickly.
It does move quite quickly, but I think you can at least partially attribute that to Hitler's expectation that after Dunkirk, Britain would fold. And when Britain doesn't fold, he has to review his plan, because invading the UK across the Channel was always going to be an extremely difficult military operation. And he was kind of hoping that a sort of political domino effect would happen and that the British would just give in and clear the deck for him. When that doesn't happen, he starts to have to think about, people talk about a two-front war. You never want a two-front war. But in a way, the existence of the Channel means that although he is technically at war with Britain, they're not actually fighting each other because the sea's in between. They're kind of sitting, staring across the Channel at each other. So it's not like he's having to commit huge numbers of forces to fighting the British. He still has to have a big army in France to kind of keep an eye on us. But there is a window for him to go east at that point.
So you said July 1940. Tell us more.
From that point on, the Germans start to move forces from France back to the east and to Poland and to Germany. There is a gradual drift of troops. And by October, there have been only five divisions of German troops in Poland, which is relatively few. It's probably 50,000. But then that number rises to 15 and then to 33 by the end of the year. So, and that includes five armoured divisions, tank divisions, so-called panzer divisions. So the German force in the east is gradually rising. But at the same time, they're trading and they're trying to make relations look normal by carrying on buying grain and everything else. The difficulty they have is the resources that they were sending to the Soviet Union, sort of in sort of manufactured products and other bits and pieces, they're having to keep hold of. So they're kind of reneging on their half of the trade deal a little bit already at that point. One of the features of this build-up, which would be a real red flag to an intelligence officer, is the OKH, the Oberkommando des Heeres, which is the high command of the German army. Mm-hmm. Up to that point, it's been in France, and it moves to just near Berlin. And so you can see the sort of center of gravity is moving from the west to the east at that point. And although the Western allies don't know anything about it, actually in December, Hitler produces one of his Führer directives. Every so often, he would produce a sort of official statement. It was secret, but it was an official statement to all his kind of senior people, his generals and his diplomats and everybody, about what his plan was. And he releases Führer Directive 21, and in that, Operation Barbarossa is named. That's the title given to the proposed attack on the Soviet Union. Otto disappears and Barbarossa arises. Barbarossa is a reference to Frederick Barbarossa, who was a Holy Roman Emperor back in the Middle Ages, and he led several crusades. He was involved in the crusades that we're familiar with, the ones into Palestine and the Holy Land, but also he led crusades against non-Christian populations in Russia and the East and the Baltics. So it's looking back on German history and picking up that figure who sort of conquered the East in the German mind.
It feels very apt, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yes. Interestingly, it's around this time that Eisenstein makes his film in the Soviet Union about the defeat of the Teutonic Knights, which is kind of the Soviet propaganda going the other way, addressing exactly the same story. But yeah, they're both sort of looking back to their medieval history to sort of inspire their people. It's quite a bad idea. I mean, nowadays, most sensible authorities suggest that if you're going to give something a code name, don't give it a code name that gives any clue to what it is. Someone who looked at an operation and it's called Barbarossa, you go, What's that operation likely to be about? Let me think. Oh, yes, Frederick Barbarossa. He invaded Russia. That might be it. So it's, you know.
Absolutely. But, Operation Giant Gun Pointing East kind
yes,
of thing.
Yes, yes. I mean, the Americans still do this. They like to go for kind of, you know, Operation Desert Shield. It's fairly obvious what it is. Whereas mm-hmm. the Britain, we use code names that mean absolutely nothing at all. Mm-hmm. Some of them are unpronounceable. So, yes, Barbarossa is launched, if you like, in December. And that gives them quite a short timescale because the original plan is to get the operation going in May because they have a limited window. By the time you get to October, it's not just that winter happens, but you get a sort of intermediate period where it rains a lot in the Soviet Union. And there are two periods of a sort of a month in autumn and in spring where everything turns to mud. And then it freezes for the winter and it turns to mud and it dries out. So you have two spells where military operations really don't work. So in order to get their 5 months in, they really need to start in May if it's going to work. Mm-hmm. Of course, the irony is they don't get to start in May. They start at the end of June, which is one of the problems, but we'll come to that.
At this stage, I'm expecting you to say Bletchley Park and its networks were listening in and they understood and they knew about the whole thing. Is that true?
Not entirely. Bletchley did gain some information about the operation. And it shines an interesting light on what Bletchley does, because people think of Bletchley as this kind of immediate news service. They get a message, it says something, and they tell Churchill that it said something, or they tell Montgomery or whatever. Bletchley are also doing long-term research. They're getting fragments from individual messages and sort of compiling them into this long-term data. And it's those types of exercises that start to reveal what the Germans are up to, because Bletchley, for example, has people listening to the German railways who use a version of Enigma, and they send messages. And so once the Germans start sending more trains to the east, the guy whose job it is to note how many trains go around Germany every day, which must have been fairly tedious, but, you know, unless you're a train enthusiast, I suppose it might be quite fun.
Yeah.
But those kinds of hints and tips are what Bletchley's picking up. And gradually, really from February and March onwards of 1941, they start to get a progressively clearer picture of what's happening. But it's incremental. They get little hints here and there and here and there. I mean, for example, in late March, they hear about three Panzer divisions which are moving from the Balkans up to Poland. They hear about Luftwaffe units in April that are moving from France to Poland. Again, in April, the railway traffic that I was talking about becomes really important. In May, more Air Force units, Flieger Corps 8, which has been involved in the campaign in Greece, is moving north as well to Poland.
At this time, the Columbia Broadcasting System calls on its correspondents in important European capitals for the latest news on the diplomatic, economic, and battlefronts. Here is a summary of press association reports from other points. From Athens comes a Greek government spokesman's report that a new counterattack by the Italians in the Albanian coastal sector had met with a fate worse than any yet tried. The Italians are said to have launched the attack with large forces and to have been repulsed with such heavy losses that they retreated in confusion. The spokesman said the Italians have not had time to reorganize.
The Greeks, in a brilliantly conducted mountain campaign, drove the Italians back and invaded Albania. Hitler was enraged. The failure of his stooge to protect his southern flank was delaying the attack on Russia. He sent a final ultimatum. For the Yugoslavs and Greeks, it was surrender or else. But the Yugoslavs and Greeks come from a long line of fighting men. Nazi slavery didn't appeal to them. At dawn, on April 6th, German bombs told the Yugoslavians they were at war with Germany. The Nazis and Italians launched a powerful and coordinated attack from all their bases, supported by virtually unopposed aerial bombardment. The conclusion was inevitable, and by the end of April, the swastika flew over the ancient city of Athens. The conquest of the Balkans was now complete. The whole force of Nazi might could now be turned loose on Russia. There was no time to waste.
What you have to remember in the spring of 1941 is there's another campaign going on, which is in the Eastern Mediterranean. At the end of 1940, the German Africa Corps with Rommel have moved to North Africa and started backing up the Italians in North Africa. And the British had kind of pushed back a bit in North Africa. But at the same time, the Germans invade Yugoslavia and latterly Greece, and of course, there's the famous parachute invasion of Crete that happens in May. So there's a whole German move to the southeast, if you like, down through the Balkans. And one of the challenges is to distinguish between what's supporting German operations that are already happening in the Balkans and in Yugoslavia from what's built up for the operation that hasn't happened yet against the Russians. And one of the difficulties Bletchley Park has is convincing the powers that be in the UK that this isn't just part of the ongoing Balkan operation, that it's actually part of a new thing that hasn't happened yet. And what's quite interesting through this whole period is there's a mismatch between the diplomatic and political intelligence and kind of idea of the war and what Bletchley are seeing on the ground. Certainly in the back end of 1940, the British government is still obsessed with the idea of Britain being invaded. There's a lot of fear that the German threat hasn't gone away, that Sea Lion is still up the German sleeves and it could happen. And it's not until well into 1941 that they really let go of that idea. In some ways, it's a sort of perverse arrogance of the British going, oh, but they couldn't possibly do anything else until they'd beaten us. The idea that Hitler's gone, oh, I won't worry about Britain for the moment. They kind of find hard to swallow. I mean, obviously, they don't want to get invaded, but they like to feel that they're important enough to get... So the government and the intelligence agencies are still thinking about the Germans invading Britain. So when they're told, no, we think the focus has moved east, they go, well, yes, of course it's moved to the east, it's moved to the Balkans. And a lot of the German moves in southern Poland and Romania are viewed as sort of defensive measures to protect the flank of the operations down in Yugoslavia and Greece. So GCNCS produces quite a lot of intelligence before the government kind of cottons onto it.
This intelligence picture that you're talking about, was that purely from sources of British intercepting German signals and using it to create this sort of incremental picture, or were there other avenues kind of feeding into that?
Well, this is what confuses the picture. There are a lot of avenues going on because from a purely SIGINT point of view, the British by this point are reading the Japanese diplomatic messages from Berlin. We've talked about General Oshima before and the purple cipher. Mm-hmm. And so the Japanese diplomats having conversations with the Germans about Russia. And so hints and tips are coming from that something might be going on. There's also, because the Americans are still neutral, there's American diplomatic presence in the Soviet Union. There's Soviet diplomats in the US. You have to remember at this point that there's a lot of countries that aren't in the war yet. So there's a lot of diplomats around the world chatting to one another and speculating about what's going to happen. And so the chatter at that diplomatic level is in some ways quite misleading. The rumour kind of gets around that the Germans and the Russians are in secret negotiations and that while there is tension between them, they're using kind of secret back channels to settle matters amongst themselves without having to go to war. And the other belief in a lot of Western governments is that Germany won't just attack Russia, that there'll be a kind of diplomatic escalation, that there will be ultimatums. You know, the Germans will say, we will go to war with you unless you do this and this and this. So this is how wars typically happen. You know, you need a kind of casus belli, you need something to kick the whole thing off. And in the absence of the Germans making those moves to ratchet up the tension, people don't believe the attack's going to happen. What they haven't appreciated is the German plan all along is to just do it out of the blue and completely surprise the Russians with it. I mean, you can't surprise them completely because obviously the strategic build-up happens and the Russians are aware that something is going to happen and the Russians are moving troops closer to the border, which is now running down the middle of Poland. They're moving a lot of forces to the west. But that's kind of part of the German plan because their idea is that if they can attract all the Soviet forces close to the border, then they can do this sort of pincer envelopment attack and capture them all in one big bite while they're close to the border in the west, rather than allowing them to fall back into the vastness of Russia. So if the Soviets are getting twitchy and moving troops forward, that's a win-win for the Germans. It's one of these cases where we tend to think, you know, Bletchley finds something out, you know, they tell the government ministries, everything's lovely. In this case, it takes a bit of work to really persuade people. I mean, interestingly, Churchill at the end of March, when he wrote subsequently, he said that Enigma had illuminated the whole Eastern scene in a lightning flash. No, it hadn't. It had taken him a while to have the lightning flash in his own head that he actually believed the story. But we do get there in the end. By May, most people in the Western Allies are pretty convinced that the invasion is going to happen pretty soon. There are a couple of things that are very significant. One is Fliegerkorps 8 that I referred to earlier. This is a real spearhead elite unit in the Luftwaffe, and it had been used for the invasion of France, and the fact that that moves away from Greece and Yugoslavia and up into Poland. That's one of their units that, if there's going to be a battle, that's the one they're going to use. So its movements alone are very significant. Another one, which crops up in several places in the accounts of this, is a unit that are specialists in looking after prisoners of war is moved to Poland. A POW cage, as it's called. It's not a literal cage. That's the term for them.
Right.
And GCNCS see straight away that moving tank divisions to the border is what you need to make a diplomatic threat to kind of present the impression that you might invade, but you don't actually need a prisoner of war cage unless you are actually going to invade.
It's not quite so much of a defensive move, is it, really?
Yeah, and it's not something you threaten the other bloke with, you know, kind of go back down because we've got a prisoner of war camp ready. You know, it doesn't work. Whereas in practical terms, it's exactly what you need. So spotting those kinds of little detailed features of the German planning is really important. The other one is a anti-aircraft unit, the so-called flak corps. Again, two of those that were a big feature of the war in France are moved to Poland. And so while there's a sort of general movement of all sorts of different troops, all soldiers are not the same. There are some that are clearly going to play a more important role in operations than others. And it's those key indicator units, spotting which those ones are and where they are, is really, really important. All of this really comes to a head at the end of May, and there's a report that was actually written at GCNCS on the 30th of May, which sums up where the intelligence has got to, what people are expecting of the Germans and the Russians. And that is actually quoted in Harry Hinsley's official history of British intelligence. He, of course, worked at Bletchley himself, and he quotes it at some length.
It becomes harder than ever to doubt that the object of these large movements of the German Army and Air Force is Russia. From rail movements towards Moldova in the south, to ship movements towards the Varanger Fjord in the far north, there is everywhere the same eastward trend. Either the purpose is blackmail, or it is war. No doubt Hitler would prefer a bloodless surrender, but the quiet move, for instance, of a prisoner of war cage to Tarnov looks more like business than bluff. It would no doubt be rash for Germany to become involved in a long struggle on two fronts. But the answer may well be that the Germans do not expect the struggle with Russia to be long. An overwhelming eastward concentration, a lightning victory, an unassailable supremacy in Europe and Asia. Such may be the plan behind this procession of troop trains from the Balkans to the eastern frontier.
It really doesn't feel like the Germans were trying to hide what they were doing. Some of the things you've told us, these movements of troops and so on, seem quite obvious.
They are quite obvious if you imagine that your wireless messages are all being listened to. I mean, the amount of information that the British can recover about what's happening in Poland is obviously limited. Part of the feed they're getting is from the Polish underground. They do have connections through SIS with the Polish underground, who has got spies on the ground, if you like, and they are reporting on German movements. The Germans obviously don't expect that we're reading all their signals traffic, so they think that that is all secret. But they do also run deception operations. They are savvy enough to military methods that they run deception operations. There tends to be an assumption that deception is kind of an allied thing, but it isn't. Everybody does it.
Divert attention, don't you,
I suppose. And so, for example, when these Luftwaffe units leave France, they leave behind radio units that talk to pretend aircraft that are flying in the air, for example, to create the impression that those aeroplanes are still in France, when in fact they've gone to Poland. So that sort of thing's going on. Unfortunately, because Bletchley Park and GCNCS have been listening to German Luftwaffe traffic for long enough, they see through the deception fairly rapidly because it's not a terribly sophisticated one. And they know enough about what real German air operations sound like to be able to spot dummy ones fairly easily. The Germans do also try and limit their communications. A lot of this stuff is done using landline communication or trying to avoid committing things to wireless because there is always a risk it's going to be heard.
Well, I suppose also if there's a sudden increase in wireless communications in a particular area.
Yeah, even if you're not encrypting it and suddenly, you know, loads of stations pop up in Poland broadcasting signals, even if they're encrypted. The sheer fact that they're doing it from Poland is significant.
That makes sense.
So they do try and keep the operation as wireless silent as they can. One of the problems they have is they have units right up in the North Cape at the top end of Norway, the northern end of Norway, and they are part of the operation because since the war with Finland, the Soviet border actually reaches all the way to Norway, and those troops up there need to know what to do when the battle starts. So they have to send stuff by wireless to these units up in the north to brief them. And again, that's something Bletchley's able to listen to. Because actually, signals that are audible by people in Norway are also audible by people in the UK. Whereas some of the stuff in the East is really hard to hear from the UK, so that is a problem. Yeah.
And you say Bletchley, you mean the Y service picking this stuff up and sending it to Bletchley Park.
And inevitably, as you get closer to the day that the attack is planned for, it's always when you're planning a big event at the last minute, everybody suddenly needs to say last minute things to each other. So your traffic is going to go up, you know, it's sort of 5 minutes before curtain call in a theatre, everyone's running around telling each other things. The wireless picture is a bit like that. So from 10th of June onwards, the attack by that point is less than 2 weeks away. Bletchley is able to see that the level of activity suggests that something's going to kick off anytime soon. But also some of the messages are reporting that units are not ready to go yet. They're having sort of last minute hitches. And so they actually report on the 16th of June, 1941, that the attack is going to be very, very soon, but not until the 19th, which is a pretty good guess because actually the invasion starts on the 22nd. So they get it within a day or two, which is a fairly decent intelligence achievement. I mean, it's a massive operation. It's quite hard to hide, but it's not just kind of one bloke crossing a river. But nonetheless, they do build up a pretty sophisticated picture of it by the time it actually happens.
The offensive started along the whole length of the front, but was concentrated on three main objectives: Leningrad, Moscow, and Kiev, the capital of the Ukraine.
Bei ihrem Vormarsch stoßen unsere Truppen immer wieder auf die Spuren der geschlagenen Sowjetarmeen. Sie sollten sich in der Stalinlinie zu neuem Widerstand sammeln. In planmäßiger Zusammenarbeit kämpfen Panzerjäger und Sturmgeschütze feindliche Stellungen im Raume des Peipus-Sees nieder und bereiten der Infanterie weiter den Weg.
And on July 17th, they captured the first main objective, Smolensk, regarded as the key to Moscow. Simultaneously, in the south, von Rundstedt's forces cut deep into the Ukraine. This was blitzkrieg at its best. The world gave Russia another 6 weeks.
Die Reste eines abgeschossenen sowjetischen Bombers. Nur ein Besatzungsmitglied konnte sich mit dem Fallschirm retten. Schon in den ersten Kampftagen errang unsere Luftwaffe die Luftherrschaft über Sowjetrussland. So wurden in den ersten 7 Tagen 4107 bolschewistische Flugzeuge abgeschossen oder am Boden vernichtet.
We are breaking programs to announce the signing of an agreement between Britain and the Soviet Union for joint action in the war against Germany. It was concluded on the evening of July the 12th, 1941, and was signed by authority of His Majesty's Government in the United Kingdom by Sir Stafford Cripps, His Majesty's Ambassador, and by authority of the Government of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics by Monsieur V. Molotov, Deputy President of the Council of the People's Commissars and People's Commissar for Foreign Affairs. The agreement was concluded.
So if the British knew, and quite close to the actual details of what actually happened, did they tell the Soviets?
I haven't seen any evidence that they shared any intelligence about this with the Soviets at this point. What you have to remember is that up until 22nd of June 1941, the Soviets aren't on our side. With the non-aggression pact and with the trade that's going on with the Germans, they're not quite the enemy, but they're pretty close. And so the perception of the Soviets isn't as an ally that needs supporting, it's as another potential enemy. So there's no real reason for them to share any intelligence with them. The other problem you have is, if you were going to, how would you do it? And the obvious thing is you brief the British ambassador in Moscow and he goes to his counterparts and everything else. But Sir Stafford Cripps, who was the ambassador in Moscow, has more or less been shut out by the Soviet foreign ministry. They don't really tell him anything. They don't have any contact with him if they can avoid it. And so even if he had intelligence to share, he probably wouldn't get the opportunity to tell anybody. And even if he did, it's unlikely the Russians would believe him. we know later on, once the campaign has got going, when the British share intelligence with the Soviets, they don't really believe it. Or they're very suspicious of it. They think it's a British plot to confuse them in some way. And so there's no incentive for Britain to tell the Soviets. And even if they did, the Soviets probably wouldn't believe them. Mm. And interestingly, from a GCNCS point of view, they have been attacking Soviet codes since 1919. The USSR has been a major intelligence target for GCNCS all the way along. One of the difficulties is that the Russian codes that they used were very, very good. Mm-hmm. They used one-time pads in particular, partly because in the 1920s, there is a moment when some Russian codes are broken and it's made public. It gets into the press, which, of course, the Russians then change everything. And so from GCNCS's point of view, up until 22nd of June, Soviet Russia has been a hostile target for them, not somebody to share intel with.
But you say they did start to share.
The first thing that happens is Churchill officially says, we're going to stop spying on the Russians because they're now our allies. So GCNCS should stop listening, intercepting Russian ciphers and all the rest of it.
Pens down, stop.
Pens down,
that.
Yeah. Close down the Russian department. Mm-hmm. We know from veteran accounts that this didn't happen. Mm-hmm. You know, the diplomatic section in particular carried on quietly intercepting Russian stuff and working on Russian codes. They didn't get far because the Russian codes were very good. But there is a pretense at, you know, bringing them onto our side at that point. And this does lead to intelligence sharing later on.
At 4 o'clock this morning, Hitler attacked and invaded Russia. Without declaration of war, without even an ultimatum, the German troops violated the Russian frontiers. All this was no surprise to me. In fact, I gave clear and precise warnings to Stalin of what was coming. All we know at present is that the Russian people are defending their native soil and that their leaders have called upon them to resist to the utmost. No one has been a more consistent opponent of communism than I have for the last 25 years. I will unsay no word that I've spoken about it. But all this fades away before the spectacle which is now unfolding. The past, with its crimes, its follies, and its tragedies, flashes away. Any man or state who fights against Nazism will have our aid. Any man or state who marches with Hitler is our foe. We have offered to the government of Soviet Russia any technical or economic assistance which is in our power and which is likely to be of service to them. Russian danger is therefore our danger and the danger of the United States. Just as the cause of any Russian fighting for his hearth and home is the cause of free men and free peoples in every quarter of the globe.
The particular example of intelligence sharing, which we've covered briefly in the podcast before, is Kursk in 1943. This is 2 years later when the Germans are planning to launch a major counteroffensive against the Russians. The Russians have been very successful and have kind of bitten off a big chunk of what up to that point is German territory. And the Germans have planned an operation to sort of nip off this salient, an operation called Citadel, which becomes Battle of Kursk, which is one of the biggest tank battles in history. Famously, intelligence giving warning of that is shared by GCNCS with the British government, and the British government share it with Stalin. He doesn't really believe it, but he already has his own intelligence sources, which give him a very clear picture of what the Germans are planning. So the fact that it's shared is not particularly significant from a battlefield point of view. It's interesting from a kind of diplomatic and historical point of view that we were trying to share it, but it didn't make much difference on the ground. It's not just the British ambassador that Stalin doesn't believe. There is a history throughout the Second World War of the Russians and Russian intelligence not believing information which another person might think quite credible. They're so convinced that everybody is out to trick them or confuse them or mislead them that they take quite credible intelligence and discard it as a trap. Back in June 1941, as the invasion is building up, there are German deserters who cross into Soviet territory and say, you know, there's 3.8 million men over there. You want to watch out. They're coming on Thursday, kind of thing. But they're considered to be deception agents. They're considered to be part of a cunning plan, which you have to ask what the Soviets thought the cunning plan was, because, you know, they've secretly planned not to invade.
Yes.
But their default position was disbelief or suspicion. Mm. And this applies to a lot of this intelligence in the build-up and the diplomatic picture in the build-up to Barbarossa in 41. But it also applies for the rest of the war, that they're deeply suspicious of not only Sigint, but all sorts of human. I mean, if they liberate their own prisoners of war, they assume that those prisoners of war have all been indoctrinated to tell lies by the Germans. So those prisoners of war, instead of getting, you know, greeted back with open arms as compatriots, they're considered to be Nazi spies. So they run on paranoia quite effectively.
But how was it framed to them? I mean, were they actually read into the background of how this intelligence was gained?
Absolutely not.
Which I suppose helps understand
why. This is the credibility
why.
Problem.
Yeah.
You say to Stalin, oh, we've got really reliable information that the Germans are about to do X or Y. Mm-hmm. And the Russians go, well, how do you know that? And go, oh, well, just take it from us. We
super
know.
Secret sources.
Yeah, don't ask where it comes from. We just know. And I mean, GCNCS has that problem with its own government.
Yes.
For the first half of the war, let alone with other people's governments. So, you know, intelligence was nevertheless. Getting people to believe it is as important as being able to collect it in many cases.
The Soviets knew that German communications were being encrypted and sent. Were they trying to break Enigma?
Well, this is a really interesting question, because we know from the First World War and from the 1920s that the Soviets were good at cryptography. Their own codes are very secure. They understand the importance of cryptography and encryption and all the rest of it. And so they certainly have the will. And we look around at Bletchley Park and we famously talk about mathematicians and chess players and all of these great minds. The Soviet Union is certainly not short of those.
Absolutely.
There are huge numbers of people who had equal sort of brain power, if you like. And the incentive is definitely there. So whether they were attacking Enigma in the same way that the Western Allies were attacking Enigma is a really interesting question. There is a historian, Jeff Jukes, who published an article back in the 1980s attacking this precise question. He also points out a factor, which is that from June 1941 onwards, there's a war going on directly between the Germans and the Russians. So prisoners are being captured, all the rest of it. We talk about pinches here at Bletchley Park and, you know, going out and capturing a weather ship to get an Enigma machine off it. Mm-hmm. It is inconceivable that the Russians didn't capture some German Enigma machines in the course of the campaign. And Jukes points to Stalingrad at the end of 1942, spring of 1943 in particular, because that operation, when Paulus surrenders with the 6th Army, is something like 20 divisions of troops. At divisional level, every German army division is using Enigma at that level. So there's at least one machine per division. So he's calculated, you know, you're talking 20, 25 Enigma machines, plus their operators, plus their code books, plus everything else. And it's possible that the 6th Army were able to build a huge bonfire in the middle of Stalingrad and get rid of them, but it's not terribly likely. He also did an analysis of what was understood of Russian intelligence. And although the paperwork is not brilliant, you can deduce some of their intelligence effort directly from looking at their intelligence materials, but you can also deduce some of it from looking at what they did on the battlefield and whether their tactics reflect the fact that they had a good understanding of what the Germans were doing or a bad one. And he argues that some of the operations that take place around Stalingrad, particularly the campaign to cut off Stalingrad from the rest of the German army, he argues that the intelligence provided to the Soviet forces in that battle is really quite poor. And you can see from the way the Soviets plan the battle that they don't really know where the Germans are. And he contrasts that with Kursk, which is 6 months later, when he has been able to show that Zhukov is writing appreciations of what he thinks the Germans are going to do in Citadel in the Battle of Kursk. As early as April, Zhukov seems to have a pretty clear picture of the German plan. And you go, this contrasts quite sharply with the lack of understanding they had 6 months before. And in between is the defeat of the 6th Army and potentially all of these Enigma machines and surrounding information. Mm-hmm. So he hypothesized, maybe this is the point when the Russians break Enigma, but they've just never told us.
So they're not just trying to break Enigma, they may actually have succeeded.
I mean, it's one of those questions that we will never know unless suddenly an archive opens in Russia and amazing things happen. But it's a theory. And interestingly, when he published the article in 1988, Stuart Milner Barry, who famously worked at Bletchley Park and who was still alive at the time, wrote a response to his article saying, obviously, we can't say one way or the other, but your argument holds a certain amount of water. You know, he didn't dismiss him out of hand. He went, yeah, this is entirely possible. It's an interesting what if, because the resources certainly exist and the brain power certainly exists. And you look at, you know, how successful the Germans were breaking British codes and, you know, and how successful the Germans were against Russian codes. You have to expect that the Russians are breaking some people's codes.
If future research question for any future of our listeners who are heading into Russian archives.
Yes, unfortunately, Russian archives, they opened up briefly in the 90s and a lot of good work was done. Anthony Beaver, for example, was able to go in and do his research for his famous book on Stalingrad and some other things. But since then, the Russians have really clamped down on their archives again now, and they only like one version of the story to be told these days. So
we live in hope.
We live in hope that things will change. It would be a publishing sensation to be able to say that the Russians have broken Enigma. But we simply don't know. On a side note to this, GCNCS is trying to break German communications on the Eastern Front. The Germans are using Enigma on a large scale out there because they've got huge numbers of troops. And some of that material is audible by British wire stations in various places, both in Palestine and in the UK. And although the British aren't involved in that fighting, knowing what the Germans are doing, even if you're not going to tell the Russians, knowing what the Germans are doing from a British point of view is really important. And if you look at the build-up to D-Day in 1943 and 1944, for example, knowing what German units are in Russia and who's fighting the Russians tells you who's not in France. So following that picture is important. But the vagaries of wireless technology mean that hearing traffic from the Eastern Front is mostly very, very difficult. Interestingly, it was sometimes very easy because of the weirdness of the atmosphere and different conditions. And I've spoken to veterans, Bletchley veterans, who were involved with listening to German voice communication. So not Morse code, not sort of Enigma messages, but voice VHF traffic. And their job was to listen to German ships in the North Sea, German E-boats that were attacking convoys in the North Sea. So really local stuff. And suddenly their headphones would crackle and they remember hearing German tank commanders in Russia. And that just some freak of the airwaves, that signal had been carried all the way over to the UK. One veteran in particular, Pat Davies, who was at Scarborough at the time working on North Sea traffic, described exactly this.
Just briefly about Withernsea and Scarborough. Withernsea, we heard a lot more HF, long distance German traffic, than most of the stations. And we had endless messages from Elbe-Weser Radio, which was, I think, a control on the Baltic. We were covering the sort of exit from the Baltic and that part of the North Sea. And two of us were sent up from there to Scarborough for a short time to try out frequencies. And it was an extraordinary place, Scarborough, because it was like a great big hangar underneath the race course. And at the time I was there, they were only listening to U-boat traffic. And the thing was to get a fix, a direction-finding fix on any U-boat that came up and spoke. U-boats did not come up much and speak, obviously. And if one did, the man in control in the center stopped everybody practically breathing while they contacted all the direction-finding stations to try and get a fix on this boat before it went down again. And we got some signals on HF which didn't seem to conform to German routines, and the Germans were very systematic. And we eventually discovered these were German tanks in Russia talking to each other. And because of a skip distance where the signals went up and hit the ionosphere, came down, we were picking up these tanks. They were not of any interest to anybody, but it was a bit weird. I find it a very grim sort of place, and I was glad to get back to Withernsea, but it was interesting.
Were the Soviets getting their intelligence from sources closer to home? We know that there were agents like John Cairncross at Bletchley Park, for example.
As far as we know, Cairncross is the only Soviet agent who was actually involved in signals intelligence at Bletchley. He's not really part of the early Barbarossa story because he didn't actually arrive at Bletchley until 1942. And his most famous role, if you like, is this Kursk operation that we've spoken about, where because Bletchley was able to intercept fish traffic, this is the teleprinter messages between German high commanders, intelligence was gained about the German plan for Kursk, for Citadel. And Cairncross did smuggle some of that out in his trousers and share it with his Soviet handlers. But ironically, it's the same intelligence that is being shared with Stalin anyway through government channels. And it may be that Stalin was able to think, oh, this supports what I'm being told. Or he might equally have thought, this is a really, really cunning British deception operation. My spy is actually a double agent because he's saying the same thing as the government is. You know, so how significant it was in terms of, you know, how much of a kind of security breach it was, is questionable because, it's intelligence that was being shared with the Russians anyway.
Do you literally mean in his trousers?
I do literally mean in his trousers. Apparently, he worked in Hut 3, where the raw intercepts would come in and the intelligence would be developed that was then turned into ultra messages or was reported to government departments. Those decrypts were routinely destroyed after they'd been sort of gone through the process. And he would actually just steal those and literally stuff them down his trousers. And then when he got on the train at Bletchley, he would move them into his briefcase and then go down to London and give them to his Soviet handlers. And they actually directed him to particular sources of information from the Fish Network. These are links between Berlin and Pskov, Helsinki, Lisbon, Istanbul, Bucharest, these kind of places. So high-level German communications. One of the problems with this story is that, as I was saying, the kind of material that Cairncross was stealing was routinely destroyed. And while we have a lot of Enigma traffic, ultra messages surviving in the National Archives, almost no Fish traffic survives in its original form. It kind of crops up in other documents, but it's the original messages have almost entirely been destroyed. One does survive, and coincidentally, it happens to be one that bears on the planning for the Battle of Kursk. It's a message from April 1943 from German Army Group South, from a general called von Feichs, and it gives incredible detail about the planning for the operation, and it shows just how much could be gained from these messages. Unfortunately, that's more or less the only one we have. We have one other in Bletchley's collection, which is from very late in the war, but almost all of them have disappeared. So there's a lot of information there that is being shared by the government, but is also being shared by Cairncross. Interestingly, Cairncross, he always justified this to himself, that it wasn't treachery, that actually the Soviet Union winning in the East was to Britain's benefit, and that this was actually a sort of a patriotic act. You know, he was also helping the day when Britain would rightly become communist as well. So he justified it to himself as a good thing to do. It wasn't, you know, just in it because he was getting bags of fivers. He was actually genuinely politically motivated. And of course, he's one of the famous Cambridge Ring, including Philby and Burgess and MacLean and the others. Philby is also in intelligence circles at this point. He's with the Foreign Office and with SIS. And he would have been sharing information with his Soviet handlers as well. But Philby is never directly involved with Bletchley Park and GCNCS. Cairncross is the only one within the sort of SIGINT side. Another thing that Cairncross would have been asked about by his Soviet handlers was British cryptographic success against other people other than the Germans. The Soviets were obviously interested in whether Britain was making any progress against Soviet codes. They were also interested in other people's attempts against Soviet codes. So if the British knew whether the Germans were breaking Soviet codes or the British knew if the Japanese were breaking them, that would have been of equal interest to the Soviets. That's not actually information that was available to the British. I mean, they learn a lot about German code breaking of Russian systems in 1945, once the war is over. The famous TICOM operation gathers huge amounts of information about Soviet codes at that point when the war's over. But while it's going on, our understanding of German and Japanese cryptographic efforts against the Soviet Union is pretty limited. So you wouldn't have been able to share much on that front.
This is the NBC newsroom in New York, and we are now ready to bring you reports from European capitals. Our own staff members are ready in England and Germany to tell you what they have seen and heard in the last few hours. In just a moment, we'll call in London, but first let's read the latest Russian communique received in New York. Moscow. Hard pressed on both flanks, the Red Army was reported today fighting fiercely against two Nazi nutcracker movements, one around Leningrad in the north, and the second near Kiev in the Ukraine. The Daily War Bulletin declared the Russians still held the Nazis stalemated on the central road to Moscow in the long-contested Smolensk salient. No major engagements took place in other directions and sectors of the front, the midday communique said.
For our listeners who know the format, usually we would get to the bit where we say this is why Bletchley Park was so important to the big picture here. But we've just been saying how here there wasn't much intelligence being shared and there wasn't much knowledge about the intelligence gathering and deciphering processes of other countries either. So I'm getting the feeling that Bletchley Park might be kind of irrelevant to this story.
The short answer is yes. This is one of the things about the Western perception of the Second World War. As we've said, it tends to be that we look at the Second World War from the Western Allies' perspective and we're talking about D-Day, and we're talking about North Africa, and we're talking about the Battle of the Atlantic and things like this. And Bletchley Park plays a really crucial role in all of those. But as I said earlier, the heart of World War II, if you like, the bit that really counts, is the war in the East. And you just need to think 1942 at El Alamein, which Churchill said was a turning point in the Second World War, the Eighth Army is fighting around about four German divisions in North Africa. At the same time, the Germans have 181 divisions committed in Russia. So the war there is just on a different scale altogether. And as we've said, the cost of it ultimately is enormous as well. We don't know whether or not it happens with the assistance of really good Soviet SIGINT or really bad Soviet SIGINT. We probably never know. But we know it worked without the assistance of British SIGINT. So it does shine a light on just how important the British activity was. One of the things that we are constantly talking about at Bletchley, because people keep asking us, is Harry Hinsley's counterfactual argument about shortening the war.
By 2 years.
It crops up everywhere. You'll find it all over the internet. Every newspaper article reports it. It all started because Hinsley gave a paper at Oxford where he said, let's imagine that there's no ultra. How do we think World War II would have played out if Enigma hadn't been broken? And he was only talking about Britain and the Western Allies. And his argument was, it takes longer to kick the Germans out of North Africa. D-Day is potentially postponed because the Battle of the Atlantic takes longer. And thus, it might not have been possible to launch D-Day and the invasion of Western Europe until 1945, which then leads to the end of the war in 1946. And as a rough sort of thought experiment, if you like, said, well, maybe the war would have been 2 years longer if ULTRA hadn't been broken. But then the day he gave the lecture, someone put their hand up at the end and said, well, what about the Russians? And he said, well, I haven't really included the Russians in this calculation. This is just a thought process. But the problem is people since have taken it as a literal statement. You know, historians say that Bletchley Park shortened the war by 2 years, which it just didn't, because you have to remember that the Russians got to Berlin in April of 1945 without any help from Bletchley Park or very much help from SIGINT, as far as we know. They just ground out an enormous war against the Germans, which they eventually won. But at the same time, you can, I think, convincingly argue that the shape of Europe would have been very different had ULTRA not allowed the Western Allies to make as much progress as they did. D-Day is possible and successful. I wouldn't claim entirely, but D-Day is significantly helped by successful signals intelligence. And what that does is it keeps the Western Allies, the US and the UK, in the race with the Russians. Because it is a race. You know, who's going to get to Berlin first? As it turns out, Montgomery steps back and allows the Russians to capture Berlin. And it costs them huge, hundreds of thousands of troops. It was a very costly operation. So the British Army was well out of it. The border between what is conquered by the Soviets and what is captured by the Allies on the other side ends up on the Elbe River, basically. And you have to imagine that if D-Day had been delayed or US and UK operations in France had been slower, the Russians would have got equivalently further across Europe. And arguably that without ULTRA, the Russians might have got to the Rhine or even the Channel. And when Churchill talks about an Iron Curtain descending across Europe, it could have descended a lot further west than it did. So it keeps the British and the Americans in the game in a way that had they not had the assistance of ULTRA, possibly wouldn't have been. Frederick Winterbottom, who worked at Bletchley, ran the SLUs, picked up on this argument in his book. It's the very first book published about Bletchley Park, The Ultra Secret, where he made the point, without ULTRA, we might have had to meet the Russians on the Rhine instead of the Elbe, and they would have stayed put. You know, a bigger chunk of Europe would have been under Soviet control in 1945, rather than, you know, there would have been only one Germany, and it would have been East Germany. Mm. And this is one of the ironies of the Second World War. We look at it from the West as a success for democracy against totalitarianism. Actually, if you count the number of countries that were communist in 1939 and you count the number that became communist after 1945, in the round, the winner is Soviet communism, not democracy.
It is my duty to place before you certain facts about the present position in Europe. From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe. Warsaw, Berlin, Prague, Vienna, Budapest, Belgrade, Bucharest, and Sofia. All these famous cities and the populations around them lie in what I must call the Soviet sphere. And all our subjects, in one form or another, not only to Soviet influence, but to a very high and in some cases increasing measure of control from Moscow.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.